whatever, 219,000 pages, and the first 10 pages are shown. Okay, I actually want to get all 219,000 pages. Okay, and the way you could do it is basically you'd go down and go to the page next. After a while, it stops. It in fact doesn't give you all the pages. It'll only give you maybe 1,000 or so pages. Okay, how could I get all the pages without paying Google anything? What? No, no. I mean, people like me. What? So no, so suppose I have Phoenix is my query, okay, and presumably, hopefully, it will be more than 219,000 pages or so which have the word Phoenix in them. I just want to get all of them, okay, for some reason. And if you just ask Phoenix, it will say 219,000, tempting you, but it will only show you the top 10, and then if you keep clicking the other pages, suppose I don't mind clicking the other pages. Really, the issue is I want to get all 290,000. What could you do? This is not just a Google issue, it turns out. It's also, again, there's a problem, I guess. Think of partitioning your query. I'll go get somebody to help me with this, but think of partitioning your query. Yes, sir.
What you could do is, assuming you have a very large abundance of cards, you could get Phoenix and some random word and just go down the list until you got.
Extremely smart idea. That's what you're supposed to do.
And then you might have to add more than one.
So, basically, in fact, there are such lists, at least for English. I mean, English is like a spoiled language. There are lists out there of all the words in English. With their frequency of usage in general text, you know, basically in the order of frequency. So what you could do is you can think of starting with your query, pick one word from that, okay, Q plus W, Q minus W, okay, and then partition them further and further. And you stop partitioning when one of these queries, each of the leaf nodes of this tree tells you that in fact, you only have 1,000 words, 1,000 hits, okay? And you can then get those 1,000 hits. Now, this is not actually a dumb idea. In fact, we'll read a paper where they wind up having to do that because they want to live off of Google and learn meaning from the web, okay? But it's also something, this sort of an idea of partitioning is something that you might wind up doing, you know, if you are trying to access a database and it has access restrictions. It won't give you everything. So one way you can figure this out is, you know, ask a whole bunch of questions and you keep answering all of them. And in fact, this sort of issue actually, the communities that think about it a lot are people who are interested in privacy and security issues. So suppose I am not allowed to answer certain questions because that would violate the patient's privacy, okay? But there are also certain other questions that I'm allowed to answer. Is it possible that somebody can ask me a large set of the legal questions and then derive the answer to the legal question? I mean, if you want to have a solution for privacy, you have to also make sure that, you know, you keep asking all the legal questions and many, many of them, And then you'll get all the answers, and you may be able to sometimes derive the answer to the question that you're not allowed to ask. Okay. I have no idea what to do regarding our dead machine here. This is off. Oh, yeah, okay. I did an app, let's see what happens. No, that is just a machine. I don't need the machine at all. I just need that guy there. Yeah, it's not doing something. Which is it? Okay. Oh, yeah, No, it shows it, but the system components don't come on. Oh, okay. That's what you think you should do? No, but it still won't because it doesn't. Let's see what we get. Oh, no. Let's see if it comes. If not, we'll just have to look at some other way of doing this stuff. No, that's the thing. That's the one that's broken. It's not working because this is now. No, it's dead. We'll have to see if by any chance it gets. Let me just try once more if any of them are dead. Okay, let me go check once more. If not, we'll just do pantomime today. Oh, okay. Hi. My podium thing is dead again. Somebody needs to open the door and kill it, and it happened once before. It's in 210 right here. Okay, so we're getting somebody. Oh, you're getting this?
It goes here,
right? Yeah.
Then it goes.
No, I don't think it. Yeah, that thing is just stuck there actually. So. Okay, let me try to see what we could do. So did people read the stuff on folksonomies? So what we were discussing towards the end of last class was if somebody sits there and annotates pages or writes pages in RDF and provides the RDF schema for the page, and if you have a reasonable theorem prover that works off of that particular language, and it turns out that RDF schema winds up being a version of description logics, which is a subset of first order logic. Description logics essentially are logics which will allow you to reason about classes, subclasses, and how properties are inherited from class subclass relations. Okay, so. So RDFS essentially provides you, this guy is gone to state, I guess. RDFS is essentially providing you a fragment of the description logic, and if somebody was to write whatever they know about a page in that particular thing, and you have like a theorem prover which works for that language, then you can ask more interesting questions, such as from the last class, remember we had this issue of if somebody has X as colleague, then it's also the case that they are the colleague of X. You know, that's an obvious answer that is not written anywhere on the page, and you should be able to answer that. Okay, things of that nature can be done. Now, the tricky issue, of course, is, and it's also the case that if somebody wrote a page in RDF and RDF schema, another person wrote another page in RDF and RDF schema, and you want to kind of combine them, there is this issue of, I may have called it has colleague, and they may have called it have colleague. And so you need some other piece of information which says has colleague is the same as have colleague. Okay. It turns out that that's again a statement at the schema level, RDF schema level, saying the class has colleague, the property has colleague is the same as the property have colleague. And once you say this, again the theorem prover can put together facts from here and facts from here to make inference. So it all looks like a nice enough solution. All this is saying, in essence, is what you learned in 471, which is if you were to formalize knowledge in some form and you have an inference mechanism for that, you can make inferences. Okay. The question that we need to worry about is, let me just go back up for a while until he comes back. The question we need to worry about is who is tagging the data? So who? Who is doing the tagging? And there are three possible solutions that are being tried. Okay. One, of course, is, so the idea is you can assume that people are well behaved and they will actually write everything in RDF as against putting it in English or some other language. They will write it in these sorts of standards. Now, if that doesn't happen, you know, it probably is not likely to happen because we still have pages that are not written in XML. Forget about RDF and RDFS. Okay. So if it's not the case that somebody is actually going to tag it, then the question would be, how would you somehow sneakily get some tags? Okay. And there are three solutions. One is essentially intercede at the time of page creation. So the idea is, in fact, most of the XML pages that are on the web right now really are being written by people who are just using some editor to make their HTML, their web page. And when this editor stores it, it basically puts it in some XML format with the tags that it makes up. Okay, so presumably at that same time, this particular editor can ask more questions, more opportunistic questions, which will allow it to tag parts of the data. Okay, that's one idea. Now the tricky issue, of course, is why would people tag? So you can ask questions to the user, then you need to somehow make, you know, this idea of incentivizing. You know, people should be made to, I mean, there should be something that makes, tempts the people to give this extra information. Okay. So one idea is instant gratification schemes. Okay. Is a instant gratification of some sort. So there's this project called Mangrove that people tried where, in essence, what they were doing was they were sort of asking people when they are making calendar entries on a group calendar, asking more semantic questions as to, you know, the entries that they're putting in. And now for having put this information, you would then be given the chance to ask more interesting questions on a calendar than you could have done if you did not put tag information. So this is sort of like your file sharing programs where to make sure that people will put files on it, they will somehow connect your ability to download files to your ability to actually upload files. Okay, so incentivizing this thing. Okay, so that's one idea. The second idea is basically, it's sort of related to this, is this idea of folksonomies on ideas like that, which is intercede at the time of access. Okay, so when people are looking at the page, try to somehow use a couple of cells of their brain, co-opt them to help you. So in the case of Flickr and all these guys, essentially that's what they're trying to do, right? Flickr and Delicious or whatever. They're saying if you were to put extra tags on these, in the case of Flickr, it's just a bunch of photographs, and so if you put tags on these pictures, then hopefully, other people can search these pictures better. And furthermore, if you use the popular tags, you are likely to be searched for more often. You are likely to be returned more often because those are the ones that people are going to search in terms of. Okay, so in fact, Flickr, essentially the interesting idea here is you're sidestepping the issue of who decides what is the standard ontology. Who decides what's the standard ontology? You're in essence allowing popularity of tags to sort of bubble up, bottom up. Okay, so if you look at any of these pages, there are certain tags which are much more highly popular than others. And the hope is that people who are interested in being seen, having their photograph be seen, are likely to use the popular tags. So popularity breeds itself. Okay, now it looks like a reasonable idea, except it has all sorts of problems too.
You want to
film
down?
I guess you can do it from there today.
Yeah.
And then I just want the laptop.
Okay.
Okay, I need to connect this. Thank you. Okay, so this is what we're talking about. So you can intercede at the way the pages are created. You can try to intercede at the time they're accessed, which is essentially what folks on MS are doing, and we'll look at a little bit more about the pluses and minuses of this. It looks as if it's solving lots of problems that we have, but it obviously doesn't necessarily. And then the third, which is actually the next major topic that we're going to discuss in this class, is to heck with people. Let them write in English, and we will have crawlers out there, except these are meaning crawlers, as against page crawlers. And they'll just crawl the web, basically extract all the facts from the web. And once you do this, all this business about who calls what doesn't matter at all, because the entire, all the facts of the web are then stored in one humongous database. Okay, this is, how many of you know Psych, the Psych story, which is Doug Leonard and a bunch of other people at one point of time said Psych, CYC. This is something common sense something, which is what they were trying to do is to write down everything that a four-year-old knows about the world in some formal language. The beauty of it is every four-year-old has to learn this silly stuff in its first 4 years, in his or her first 4 years. Whereas if you write it down once, and you put it on Kazaa or something, everybody can download it. And you don't even need to actually pay for it. And essentially, once you write it down, somehow all these facts are available everywhere, and in any language, in any reasoning program, which has all this, facts that we take for granted and the axioms that we take for granted, can use them. This is universal background knowledge. Whatever a four-year-old knows is reasonably seen as a universal background knowledge, right? So that's a possible idea. So you can actually generate psych by looking at the web, because web already has a chunk of what everything, all the things that we know about. So if we somehow can convert English back into some formal description. Okay. Now this looks quite blue skyish, but again, you may not have to do all the way there if you start, you know, picking up some of the facts as against all of it. Okay. That still is useful. So for example, suppose I want to know, let's say what do I want to know? I want to know all the movies that were ever made. Okay. You know, suppose I just want to go through the entire web pages that Google has and extract the movie names from that. That should not be that hard as figuring out physics from, you know, Google. Okay. And that sort of thing is actually being done, and we'll look at some of that, as the next topic. Okay. So the idea, but I put it here because it too can be seen as an answer to the question, who will annotate the data? Well, in a sense, if I am converting, I mean, my program is converting English into facts, then it annotates it, in a sense. Okay? The last 2 years in the WWW World Wide Web Conference, I think 2 years back, Semtag and Seeker, which is the IBM project, got the best paper award, and they were trying to do this. Okay? I think last year, there's another project called Know It All, which essentially is trying to do the same thing, but of course, small levels of success, all of them. And they were like runner-up for a best paper award. And we'll look at a little bit of what Know It All does, and it's not that hard to understand, okay, what's going on, in terms of at least getting reasonable facts. Okay, so that's our next big topic, but let me spend a little more time on this. You had a question. That's like, yes, yeah, in fact, not just 5 years ago, I think it's at least 87, 80s, mid-80s. It's easier said than done, it turns out, because common sense knowledge is highly tentative. You know, there are many, many exceptions to every darn rule that you know, okay, and we always know which exception of the rule to use to explain the answer. But if you have to write down, it's much harder. Okay, so that project is still going on. But in some sense, again, what they were trying to do is get all the knowledge up in there, and we'll pay people to write this knowledge down, and then we'll start selling it to, you know, people who want to use this knowledge. Okay, and some of these other guys, they essentially, one of the interesting things in a web is instant gratification. So you do a little and see what happens. Okay. And so, for example, in the current information extraction techniques, they are not really looking for the kinds of formal theories that psych people were trying to write down. The project that you have in mind is psych, CYC. Doug Leonard is the guy who is running it. What we are looking for are much simpler stuff as, give me all the names of countries and capitals. Okay, or give me all the names of the movies. Tell me all city names. Now, there may actually be some databases which already have this information, but suppose if I don't, if they don't exist, those, can I pick them up just by looking at the web? Okay, let me give you, since I'm talking about this, let me give you my favorite story of this kind of using web to, so one way this sort of thing happens in automated information extraction of this kind, like for example, trying to pick up all the city names. The one way that could happen, in essence, is by looking for, let's say, suppose you want to see whether or not Yakima is a city. Yakima is a city in Washington. And in fact, it's used in this Know It All paper, so that's why I know. So you want to know whether or not to add Yakima to the list of city names you have. So one way of figuring this out is ask Google, is Yakima a city? And of course, Google won't say anything about that. Instead, if you have a hypothesis that Yakima is probably a city, you can test it. How would you test whether or not Yakima is a city? By just using Google. Ask the number of hits for Yakima plus city. Ask the number of hits for Yakima. Take the fraction. That's in essence a mutual information. Okay? Now, of course, if the higher that mutual information, the higher the chance that Yakima is a city. So in fact, the example that they use in the paper is, now you can use the same thing to figure out Avocado City, okay? And so you write Avocado plus city and see the number of hits Google returns, divided by the number of hits Google has for avocados. And you will see that most of the users of the word avocado are not connected to city. Whereas most of the users of, a larger fraction of the users of the word Yakima are connected to city. Okay, so that is a good enough reason to say that Yakima is more of a city than avocado is. Okay, now of course this is all these recent years, but people have been co-opting Google to do fun stuff like this all along. Okay, my favorite story is one of my former students Yaking Liye, who is now in Microsoft Research in Beijing, who had obviously some problems with English. You know, I mean, most of us who are not native speakers don't know which preposition to use in what context. Okay, so how do you figure this out? He used to use me most of the time for that sort of stuff. So it's like an Indian correcting a Chinese guy's English so that it would be read by a Russian in some conference. But that's how science is. So however, once in a while, he would be nice to me and he would use Google instead. Okay, so he would actually make the entire sentence, give it to Google. And he used to write small sentences, 10-word sentences. So give it to Google and see how many hits you get. And then if he has an alternative for the same sentence, give the alternative and see, give it to Google again and see how many hits you get. And whichever is the higher number of hits, that must be what people are, you know, using. Do you understand what I'm saying? The pages were not written to help Nie figure out how to write English. But neither were the pages written to help you guys figure out whether Yakima was a city or not. Okay, once you have humongous knowledge, co-occurrence statistics wind up becoming relevant. And they actually become significant. This is something that's understood in natural language processing. In natural language processing, one of the biggest revolutions that happened some 10, 15 years back is people realized that we should really do a lot more statistical natural language processing. Okay? Forget about trying to figure out, you know, meaning and trying to put together sentences and trying to decode sentences. Instead, just look at large corpora, large, big text. And then do simple statistical analysis such as co-occurrence statistics. And the fact that whatever this guy was saying, LSA got 60 percentile in TOEFL synonyms test, which is more than most Indians get, is pretty sad. But on the other hand, it also tells you that if you have a large enough corpora, you can get a lot of this information. In fact, there is a paper by a guy who I'll send a link to called Peter Turney, I think, who compared TOEFL synonyms test, on TOEFL synonym test, how LSA does versus how this mutual information that I just told you, which is the number of hits for Yakima plus city divided by the number of hits for Yakima. And the same thing except do it for the synonyms. And he compares who does better, you know, which of the two mindless techniques do better on what you think are very mindful activity, which is figuring out synonyms. But once you have large enough data, co-occurrence might start having more significance than you can expect. Okay? But we will see that, you know, in some sense I gave away some of the interesting part of Know It All. But hopefully, if we don't get to it, I'll get you the page paper. And, you know, you should read it and we'll discuss it more next class. Okay. Now, for the collaborative tagging. So the good part, you know, this is just, here's a scenario where people are in the research community are trying to figure out what do these things mean? Are they anything more than just garbage? Okay. So the good part of taxonomies are, in essence, you're not paying anybody. You know, people are just out of their own volition doing this. Okay. So this is the theory of many, many minds, you know, even if most of them are below par, many, many minds doing a few cycles can be better than a few minds spending humongous number of cycles. You know, this collaborative anything, collaborative X. Okay, so the folks enemies can work well for certain types of information where they wind up giving reward for tagging. Okay, and And if you tag with the more popular categories, you wind up getting bigger reward, because in essence, you wind up being, I mean, in the case of pictures, you know, everybody wants to see their pictures be, you know, I guess, brought up, you know, for every random query out there. And you are more interested in using the popular tags. Okay? People wind up using that. And so in some sense, there is a way a standard ontology could develop. Except this standard ontology is not designed by anybody, and so it has all sorts of problems. It has plus points, but it also has minus points. It turns out that normal ontologies might not have redundancy, not too much redundancy. You won't have 15 names for the same class of objects. If there are, at least you will say name and all the synonyms of it. But when people are making up tags at will, there may be synonyms, and both of them might continue to prosper. Okay. Let's see. So this is basically how Wikipedia itself is tagged on Delicious, which is one of the tagging engines for, I think, this is, the Flickr is for the photos, and this is for pretty much any URL, okay? And so you'll notice that about 109 people who tagged it call it reference, and then on the other hand, there are all these people who call it portal, community, miscellaneous. The problem is pretty much any of these are reasonable tags. And what we really care about is that one set of tags, one particular, you know, a small set of tags become default so that we can communicate. And so this is one way it's happening, because, you know, popularity beats popularity. Okay. The negative part of it is this looks like a good thing. Something useful is happening there. But it does not necessarily answer all the questions that we had. So, you know, on one hand, you are talking about RDF and RDF schema, and where are the tags coming from? On the other hand, at the other end of the room are these people who are essentially tagging information, tagging pictures, et cetera, et cetera. But they may not necessarily become well-behaved ontologies that you want. In particular, there are the problems such as no synonym control. You know, in fact, apparently me is a very useful tag, very popular tag in Flickr. And you know how much content it has. Everybody is a me. And so it's like, obviously there's a lack of precision, and there is no hierarchy at all. These are all flat names. There's very little hierarchy. And in fact, that paper that I asked you to read, which is basically by a sociologist, ethnologist or whoever, who was trying to understand this phenomenon, and he has all these interesting observations about how people are, hierarchies are emergent, you know, in funny ways, even though people don't actually design them. Okay, these are large, scale number of people taking part in it, and so interesting phenomenon can come out that you may not have expected in the beginning. I love this, which is at this point of time, taxonomies, I mean, the ontologies designed by humans are to ontologies designed by, are emergent from Flickr and all these Delicious, etc., as Wikipedia is to Encyclopedia Britannica. Okay? And you know that nobody can be sued if Wikipedia tells you the wrong stuff, while you could presumably sue somebody in an encyclopedia community if they tell you this thing. But on the other hand, you know which gets used much more. Okay, so that's a very interesting connection there. I don't think we have actually closed the gap. All I'm saying is this is a way you might be considering doing tagging. There's a humongous number of research questions as to how can you direct undirected activity by billions of people into something that's much more than the sum of the parts. Okay, so I made up this. I'm sure there's a better name for this. This comes from this idea that the entire internet economy is based on monetizing eyeballs. That's the word, that's the phrase that they use. Okay, Google is doing well because every time you're looking at a page, you're looking at an advertisement, that's, they're trying to give a value to it. The advertisers are giving money to Google because every eyeball counts. And if you then click on it, then obviously, I mean, so the phrase is monetizing eyeballs. And so what we are now trying to do in these kinds of thing is, for the 3 seconds that the user is on a particular web page, their entire brain, or a reasonable portion of it, is at the mercy, I mean, is available for this web page. So let's try to get them to do useful stuff. Okay, collaborative X, you know, collaborative filtering that we already read about is a particular type of passive activity where nobody, I mean, you just use the buying patterns of previous people to suggest to the new people what they should be buying. But things like tagging, they're much more active. You know, you are essentially tagging, I mean, you're spending extra time on the web page. You know, rather than just upload the photographs, you're also putting tags. And if you put tags, you're putting, you know, spending more time, and there better be some way you feel that that's a good thing for you to do. And the usual way they're doing is incentive mechanisms. What can you do to make them be interesting to you? There's a very interesting project that some of the people in the department, including, you know, actually led by Chitta Baral, are trying, called collaborative curation. Okay. This is a research project. It's not yet, I mean, there are papers on it, but it's not yet large scale. But the idea there, in essence, is the following. You have a bunch of biologists. There are trying to read billions and billions of papers, millions and millions of papers at least, and trying to figure out whether something, and in a biology, unlike, I don't know, how many of you know enough about biology? If you don't, then whatever I say is true. Unlike engineering sorts of disciplines, biology is a highly fact-oriented field. You know, it's not like just give me a couple of theories and I'll work out the details. Einstein won't do well there. Now, Einstein is this guy who said, I want to know God's thoughts, everything else is details. Now, unfortunately, in biology, God's thoughts won't get you anywhere. You know, I mean, there are a lot more details that you need to know. And so every paper is essentially writing yet another detail about how some particular protein works or some particular, pathway signaling works. And so if you are a biologist, you're trying to go through all these papers to figure out the ones, the facts that are of relevance to you. And so NIH is interested in curating all the papers. NIH is the National Institute of Health, which is the NSF equivalent, except for much, much more deeper pockets. And they're interested in curating all the biological literature. Okay, so what do? They have this NIH has, what is the main site that they have? Which there is a particular site where, what?
PubMed.
PubMed is this site where they essentially collect all the abstracts of all the papers and all the keywords, etc. And so you can at least do keyword-based search on the abstracts of all the papers. Okay, and then from there you'll get a bunch of abstracts, and then you read the entire paper to see whether or not, you know, the abstract is delivering, I mean, the paper is delivering on the promise that the abstract tempted you with. Okay, and so an idea that Chitta and all these guys are trying to do is the following, which is, why don't we try to extract certain stylized patterns from abstracts and maybe even the paper. Okay, and then store these. Now, most of these patterns that are extracted may be just as accurate as the patterns that we extracted about Yakima being a city, which almost as easily could have said avocado is a city. Okay, because if there were different types of it. So the facts that you extract are not necessarily likely to be correct facts. You know, the extraction software might have problems. We will actually talk about how these kinds of extractions can be done by using slightly more natural language processing, such as part of speech tagging, than we have talked about till now. Okay. Now, the question is, if you are just doing it by yourself, your program is doing it, then you cannot guarantee that it's accurate. But the idea that they have is, when somebody is looking at an abstract, they went to the PubMed and they were looking at the abstract, at that time a little window opens. Okay, and that window shows the facts that have been extracted from this particular abstract. And you are asked, you get a chance to agree or disagree that this fact actually follows from this abstract. So here are humans who can understand the text, and you know, and then you're trying to co-opt them into solving your problem. Okay? Again, an issue where you're trying to co-opt the brains that we do have, that your users hopefully do have, to do something that you don't have to solve from scratch, natural language processing from scratch. And whenever I think of it, I think of this beautiful story from, I mean, there are lots and lots of these projects. We'll talk a little bit more about collaborative curation a little later. But this is just one interesting thing that's happening right here. But there are other people trying to do these sorts of things where, as long as you have the user in front of you, you know, why can't you just use some of their empty cycles? You already know this Google thing, right, that you can donate idle CPU cycles, right? What we would like to have is idle brain cycles to be donated. CPUs, you know, who cares? And I'm sure Google or somebody would come up with some patch that we'll all be wearing, and, you know, during the exam time you have to remove it because otherwise it's, you know, sucking up all your brain to do PubMed or something. But, you know, it's a great idea. Okay? And the best story I have about this is how many of you know Hitchhiker's Guide to Galaxy? So what is the story of mice? What's the story of mice? What are the mice doing? Mice essentially, and we are a big experiment that's being run by the mice. We think we own the mice, and you know, basically the entire Earth is a big experiment that the mice have designed to figure out the question for whose the answer is 42. And you know, and we're all collectively helping somebody else. We're thinking we're having a great life, okay? And that's fiction, but the fact is coming close to it. We may be thinking that I'm reading a particular abstract, but I'm also helping something else, okay? But there are beautiful research issues here as to how would you set up these things such that people are likely to actually do that extra bit of tagging or the extra bit of voting. How do you incentivize the interactions between the user and the web page such that, you know, they would actually do things for you? Okay? It's an open, completely open research area right now. Okay. What I want to get to next, if I could, let me see, 1 second. One other thing, I do want to flash a couple of slides that we didn't get to do earlier. This is a slide that I added. I was actually mentioning this before we got the slides up. This is essentially talking about the connection between RDF, RDFS, and the general problem of knowledge representation and reasoning. And in a sense, the fact that RDFS and RDFS together are essentially capturing a certain fragment of first-order logic. Okay, called description logic. And of course, already there is trouble in paradise because people are complaining that that's not expressive enough. Now, the problem is the more expressive you get, the harder the reasoning is. Okay, so now already there is a new standard that they are now after called, so there are a bunch of problems that they have come up with, and they won't be surprised that there would be problems with for any subset of first order logic. Okay, and then they came up with a different standard called OWL, which in essence allows you to say more interesting facts. Ultimately, it's a syntactic form of the facts that you're allowed to do. Okay, OWL is a sort of a superset of RDFS. Okay, that's one thing I was saying earlier, but I just wanted to show you this here. And the other thing is, this is this issue, the semantic web solution to how do different stores or different databases communicate with each other. In essence, what they're saying is there would be one universal ontology that somebody makes up, okay, and then everybody essentially has in their RDFS portion of it, they have a mapping between whatever they are calling various fields and how they are connected to the universal language. Now, the big advantage claimed here is once you have any standard, it doesn't matter, whatever the standard is, whichever becomes popular, then you only wind up writing, each of us wind up writing only one mapping of us to the universal language, universal ontology. As against if there is no common ontology, then you wind up doing N mappings, where N is the number of other databases that you ever want to deal with. This is considered the advantage. So from total of N square mappings, you get down to N mappings. Okay, or for a single database, from a total of N mappings, you only just do one mapping. Okay. So this is very much the database, the Amazon ultimately has to take responsibility for connecting it up to this universal network. Now it turns out that these things are actually working quite well on small communities which do want to get along. Okay, but then communities that want to get along probably could be pushed a little bit more, such that they'll say, to heck with this, we'll all talk the same language. That's what we talked about when we said universal, I mean, when we talked about variations of XML, such as electronic vendors using a particular XML. All of them just use it. If all of them use the same language, then the mapping issue just disappears. So you do want to combine, you have to, in your head, make sure that you figure out this connection between semantic web idea of actually mapping. You have a separate language, but then you map it to the universal language, which is sort of like an RDF, RDFS level, versus all of us decide to heck with all other languages, English seems to be good enough, and we'll all speak English, broken or whatever. And then that, then you no longer need a translation service. And in that case, you know, you have English, it becomes your XML, in a sense. So XML with specific tags. Okay, so depending on how much people want to get along and how much they can be coerced into being, coerced into losing their individuality, you could actually solve this problem in XML itself. We have solved this problem for small communities. Maybe larger communities which don't want to agree for a single language but wouldn't mind doing some mapping can get along with this. Okay. So there is this, this is a layer cake picture. I have to show it to you because anybody asks you, if you say that you know semantic web, they'll ask you, do you know the layer cake? And this is a layer cake. And most of it is bogus because the layers are changing as we speak. But this is the idea that, you know, that was sort of articulated in the Scientific American paper, was that you have your lowest level, which is your, the character codes and the URL descriptors, in a sense. And then you have XML space, okay? And on top of that, you have relations and how the facts are over the relations. And then on top of that, you can start talking about mappings between multiple predicates. And then, which I didn't, the other part that I didn't even go into, they had in their dream this idea that when there is an answer, then you ask, prove it to me, to the web, and then it needs to prove it to you. So then you need proof languages, standards for proofs, standards for exchanging proofs. What's nice is there are people out there already working on standards. I mean, semantic web is a bunch of overzealous standards people, who are making lots of standards, but nobody else other than them is probably using it. And they themselves are not necessarily using it because they're too busy making a new standard every day. But there is a nice, there's an interesting work at Stanford called Proof Markup Language, which basically talks about how you could exchange proofs. Okay, so all the answers for your woes according to semantic web is you make up the right standards and follow them. And which does bring us to that second part of this thing that we talked about, which is, if given this legacy pages that are out there which don't follow any standards, how do you tag them? And if nobody wants to follow your standards, how do you, automatically tag their pages? That makes up an interesting issue. Okay. So you said, okay. So we will now, the second part essentially is sort of a continuation of the previous one, in the sense it's connected to this issue of tagging, but it's also its own thing. There is this whole issue How could you, motivating information extraction, I motivated it one way in the previous slide saying, look, you could actually extract facts from text, and then when you do extract them, then you decide what the relations and what the what the relations are, and so you know how to store them. Okay, you the program. Okay, so if this one guy in charge of everything, then there is no question of standard. Whatever that one guy does, he's the standard. Okay, the problems of standards come when there's more than one guy involved. Okay, so that's one way of getting to information extraction. The other is the following, which is, remember we were saying that text by itself, you can only do IR, information retrieval. If you have structured data of any kind, you can do more interesting processing. So for example, the classic example of Sightseer with, give me all the papers that cite Rao that are not written by Rao. Okay, to be able to answer that, you need to have structure for the paper, saying there's a title part, there's an author part, there's an abstract part, there is a body part, there's a references part. Otherwise, you can't even express this. If it's just all text, then you don't know how to express this query. So there is an advantage oftentimes for just finding structure from the text. The structure is obvious to the humans, but it's not obvious to the bag of words model search engine. So somebody has to come in between and basically convert text into, at least parts of the text, into structured information. Okay, to do that too, you would wind up having to do information extraction. So information extraction, there really are two, let's go through it very quickly. Most of it is pretty obvious. So you can apply it to any kinds of text, any types of web pages, but I think you want to differentiate between two types. One are web pages that probably are generated by programs. And we talked about it a lot during this course, right? Many, many web pages that you see out there are actually generated by a back-end database server. Okay, so there is a standard translation from TOPL to pseudo-English. Okay, they think that pseudo-English will impress humans. And you, the program, want to undo that standard transformation they did. Since there is a standard transformation, oftentimes it's possible to invert it by learning. Okay? That's essentially that version of information extraction. So there too you have essentially an employment opportunity is given and you're trying to pick from that the location where the employment is occurring, the amount of money they will give you, what are the languages that you're supposed to know, C++, whatever, and that sort of stuff. And then you store it as a relation with the field, you store it as a table. Okay. Now that aspect of information extraction has been called wrapping and unwrapping. So it's actually somebody wrapped the data into a pseudo text. You unwrap it. Except because of the way people behave, for some reason we call the unwrapping programs wrappers. Don't ask me why. This is not the only place we do this. Many many places. There's lots and lots of examples in language where you call something the opposite of what it is actually doing. And I'm sure I can think of other examples. But the unwrapping programs are called wrappers. Okay? But that entire literature, in essentially learning wrappers, maintaining wrappers, that becomes part of information extraction. Okay? The second aspect of information extraction is extracting information from non-templated text. That is like text of the kind that you and I would write. Okay? So that's basically natural language processing. So you need to use much more NLP style techniques. The kind of thing that I talked about in the beginning, which is know-it-all, figuring out all the cities and so on, those are basically free text information extraction. Okay? Whereas things like converting from Amazon's display list of books into a set of relations, a set of tuples, saying book title, book author, price, etc. Those are unwrapping. And those are wrapping. Okay. Those are two types of things. And we'll first talk about the template text one because that's much better understood. And I, in some sense, already talked about the unstructured text, how to do, the know-it-all example was that. But we'll come back to it next class more after you read the paper, okay? So, anyway, this is history. Actually, you know, who are the people who are interested in this stuff? Defense Department is always interested, okay? So back in 1990s, DARPA funded a bunch of money to people to read newspapers and write down facts automatically, presumably to stop things like terroristic acts and so on. And you can see how successful we have become in that. But I think they pulled the plug on it. They no longer, message understanding conferences were supposed to be trying to do natural language processing without doing NLP fully. They tried some of it. And they lost interest in it, but now it's back into popularity a lot. I mean, if you go to any Defense Department person and say, I am thinking that I might be considering making a program which may be sort of, you know, kind of look at text and maybe, you know, terrorist, before you complete your words, you'll have money in your pocket, and then you can come and use it. Okay, it's like they know that it's a humongous problem. And pretty much anything, you know, I think Defense Department thinks of web as web of terrorism. And so you guys think World Wide Web, they think of World Wide Web of terrorism. And so they're interested in finding connected component of terrorism. And I don't know how many of these guys actually have computers and, you know, using these things. But, you know, there's a lot of interest in that stuff. And then there is, you know, basically understanding messages and writing small facts down. And CIA, NSA. NSA is a National Security Agency. CIA is, of course, you know what CIA is. And then this job resumes are the employment opportunities. Those are also classic cases of converting some templated text back into a table. Okay. These are all the examples. So something like this is a job posting. And what I want is to be able to see which are the important pieces in this. And I say, oh, there's a PC there, there's a voicemail there, there's a software programmer there, and there's a DOS there. And then you pick these pieces up from the text, and you generate this. This is a tuple. So think of this as the column names, and these are all the values for a particular tuple. Okay? This is what we're trying to do. So there's an Amazon book description, and notice that in the case of Amazon book description, since it is actually a HTML page that Amazon generates, you may as well use it as an HTML page, because they would have done indentation, they would have done blinking, all that stuff to help humans figure it out, and you can co-opt those meanings back into something that would mean something for your unwrapping stuff. Okay, so that's your HTML source for some book description, and so you pick it up, you know, that this is the title, and this must be this is the author name. And so you pick these up and write down, and so here is the price. Okay, and you write down a tuple like this. Okay, now of course, if you have direct access to Amazon's database, you can cut this out. But oftentimes you don't. They don't even realize that you're doing this. Okay, so basically, you're trying to, for example, this sort of thing can be done by a third party who is comparing books sold by 15 different book sellers, putting all the, basically join that table on, let's say, the title of the book. So you would know where is the cheapest price for this book. And you think Amazon is really trying to help you do that? Obviously not. Okay, but it's done anyway. A classic example of that, all of you know, is Frugal, right? You know Frugal. Okay, in fact, I've never used Frugal until day before yesterday when I bought a pair of shoes. So if I do get them next week, I'll wear them and you'll know that it works. Okay, but you know, Frugal does that essentially. It's essentially, you know, converting records from multiple sources, and then it's able to show you that for this particular shoe, these are all the places that sell, and you know, this is the prices and so on. Okay. So the examples that I've showed, the previous example I showed is essentially sort of like a web extraction where it's a templated text that you're trying to unwrap it back. Okay? And it has nice names called screen scraping. So you're trying to scrape off information from the screen. And who does the screen scraping? If you don't do graduate school, and you graduate and go to Google or something, you know, you would wind up doing wrapping software. At least until a couple of years back, you were doing that. Okay. A lot of highly paid employees will develop and maintain wrappers, okay, for various databases. In fact, Jung Lee is one of the first companies which did something like this employment opportunities, or the comparison book shopping sort of a project. And Peter Narvig was on Jung Lee, and one time people were asking, so what exactly were you guys doing? And he said, most of the time they will write the wrappers, and next day morning they will break, and then they'll rewrite them, and next day morning they'll break, and they rewrite them. That's what they did. Okay. People write the wrappers. That's the simplest solution. And you know, if you already paid a bunch of money to people who are not doing anything, then you know, ask them, just do this. And then there's a project for you, so you do it. Okay. So the way you would do it is, you know, basically if you are writing these little programs, you can still write scripting. Okay. So one idea would be, what sort of scripts would you write? So the two pieces of things that you have are, if it is a HTML page, there is sort of a DOM tree. It's basically the hierarchical organization in terms of the tags. Okay. So you may be writing part of your script to navigate to the right place in the tree using the tags. And then once you get to the end of the tag, that might be a bunch of text. Okay. Then you give regular expressions saying skip, 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 grab, skip, 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 gap, grab. Okay. Regular expressions are used by all sorts of programs, and you know, there are standardized syntaxes for them. Okay, so you might write these regular expressions and then check it out if it works. And if it works, then you just do this script multiple times. Okay, the question, of course, is for example, in the DOM tree, you might write something like, you know, get from HTML to body to B to character data. That's the first part, and in the second part, In the second part, I would say, for the price, do that regular expression. Okay? Now, oftentimes, of course, before the actual data occurs, there is a pre-filler which tells you the data is coming. So you first look for that and then grab the data. And oftentimes, after the useful data is over, there's also ending of it. And then you can also look for the ending of the data. All of which is written in terms of regular expressions or in terms of traversal over the XML, the HTML tree. Okay. Now, you guys, how many of you know Emacs? You can write macros in Emacs. I'm sure you know you can do it for Word too. So if you want it to do something repetitive, you say I'm recording a macro, and you do it. Okay, and then you end, and then it remembers as a macro. So for example, I can say start from the beginning of the line, go 5 words, then copy the next word, keep it somewhere, then go down 4 more lines, then you know, go 5 words to the right and pick the next word, stop. And then that's a macro now, and I can repeat, and as I'm basically doing it in front of you. I'm doing it in front of you, in front of Emacs, and Emacs then remembers the keyword, the keystroke sequence, and it just replaces it. Okay, so at one level, you can automate this by, in essence, recording the keystrokes that people do when they are looking at. So you can show the user, show a human being the Amazon book list, and then they can show, you know, mark this piece and say this is price, and they can also show how to get there. Okay, so that winds up making, rather than write the programs from scratch, you can show it, you can demonstrate it, and then of course, if there are variations among pages, so for example, some pages there are multiple authors, so you can't just skip to the next line after author and say that the second author is actually the price of the book. Okay, so you need to have the possibility that there are multiple authors, and so you wind up recording over multiple these examples. You have multiple positive examples, and you want to learn the tightest regular expression which would capture all of them. That's a learning problem. Okay, so rapport learning normally works that way. Let's see if I have a picture. Okay, so rapport learning basically works like that. So a human would, using a thumb GUI, would show how to extract patterns on a bunch of examples. So now you have a bunch of labeled pages, and then you do learning, inductive learning. Now, notice that this inductive learning system isn't going to be doing nearest neighbors, right? It's not going to be doing naive Bayes. What it is doing is it's actually learning a hypothesis. Okay, the hypothesis for this particular kind of things, the language for the hypothesis would be regular expression, oftentimes. So it's trying to learn the tightest regular expression that winds up being consistent with all the labeled pages. It's also learning. In fact, the definition of learning is just find the hypothesis that is consistent with the data, and then use it next time around. Okay? So in fact, there's a tremendous amount of literature in the last 4 years or so, last 10 years or so, on this process of learning wrappers automatically. Okay? Now, oftentimes, after you learn the wrapper, somebody on the Amazon side feels that, it's not exactly looking good. Okay, so I need to change the HTML page a little bit. So they'll put some extra bold lettering, or they put some extra additional characters or something. And so the wrapper breaks. So, this happens all the time. If you are in, Emacs macro fan, then, if you have a bunch of lines which all have proper structure and some other line doesn't, then the macro will still work, except it just gets gobbledygook, right? So the question is, that basically brings up the issue of maintaining wrapper. In the good old days, well-paid employees will come back early in the morning and check whether, all the people who are providing the data, if any of them have behaved badly overnight and changed their page, and then, so they very quickly set it up such that it again winds up being correct with respect to this. Okay. Now, if you want to do learning, if you want to automate this, then the idea would be to figure out that something has gone wrong. Okay. So not only would you have to learn the wrapper, now you have to realize that the wrapper isn't working well. Okay. How do you figure that out? It turns out that too can be posed as a learning problem. Okay, basically what you would say is previously, this is as simple as this. Previously, I used to get string here, number here, string here in every tuple. Now, if all of a sudden I came this morning and I'm getting string, nothing, number. There's something wrong. It doesn't take an Einstein to figure out that, the data characteristics are no longer the same. Forget about the content. It's just the profile of the data is no longer the same. So all you need to do is, something went wrong. Okay. So you very quickly figure out, so this is basically the life cycle of a wrapper. So somebody makes the wrapper first. A learning algorithm makes the wrapper. Remember that when I say learning algorithm, in the old days, back before 1940s, computer was what? Was in those cases highly paid undergraduate students. Human beings were called computers. A computer actually was a name that we just used to mean a little machine that we have on our pages. Computers are calculating people. Okay? When all our farms are being farmed by machines, farmer would be a tractor. Right now, farmer is still this guy in Iowa. Okay? Previously, there used to be some other guy in New York who was the computer. He no longer has a job because we have real computers, non-human computers. Okay, So the point is that what people were doing are being done more and more by machines. And even in the case of wrappers, the same exact thing has to be done if the learner is a human being as against an automated program. The life cycle maintenance remains the same. Okay. So the question would be, you know, you basically generate a wrapper, and then you have to figure out if something went wrong. And if something went wrong, you have to reinduce the wrapper using new examples. So it's a maintenance of a wrapper. Now the interesting thing is, figuring out something went wrong is more on data profile. So let me see if it has. So they have this idea. There's a paper that actually by Lehman and Minton, Christina Lehman and Steve Minton, from which that slide is taken. Basically, they were saying, say, if you had previously a street address, it was sort of like number followed by caps, and ending with caps, something called boulevard, caps, caps. That's the profile. Now, if I wind up getting a bunch of number, number, followed by dollar, 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 followed by number, number, then it's not the same profile. Forget about the content. It's not even the same data type. Okay? When that happens, then you raise alarm and say the wrapper is not working. You, the program, raise alarm and say the wrapper is not working, and you relearn the wrapper. Okay? So this is just an example, I guess, that this was originally working wrapper which was able to capture this information, and then they changed something between this and this. They changed something. Okay, I guess the Lindbergh became capitalized or something. And so suddenly, if you are going by the HTML tree structure, where you are trying to co-opt HTML into meaning, then you very quickly pick nil, nil, $21, this title usually ships. Okay. This happens all the time. I told you, did I tell you the LBAC, T-Stock, that was Google Scholar doing unwrapping of titles, okay, of papers. And they decided that the second line of a paper that we wrote was author names. And so they just made us into, made three people, LBAC, T-Stock, trying to authors, while it is actually looking back, taking stock, going forward, is part of the title. Okay. So clearly Google doesn't have a maintenance on this, because this was papers, and you know, professors pay very little for picking up papers from the web. And so there's not much interest in that. But if you are like a comparative shopping agent, and you, people won't be happy if you started showing these kinds of tuples. Okay. Especially if this winds up being nil, and your program says nil means zero, and so all of a sudden this one particular store is always ranked high because everything is zero cuts there. So then, you know, you relearn, and so, and by the way, the side of these are essentially showing you the kind of hypothesis they are learning, the macro they are learning, and then they relearn the macro. You know, and previously they had a macro, and then they relearn the macro, and then they get back to normal. Okay, whatever I skipped, there are at least 100 papers on learning wrappers, maintaining wrappers. Most of them, like 80 of them, are learning wrappers with different regular expression patterns, etc. And at least about 20 papers on maintaining them. Okay, so we'll stop here as far as the web extraction is concerned. And the next part that we will be looking at is, when we come back next class, we'll talk about what would be involved in extracting patterns from pretext without me becoming RA false and teaching you natural language processing. Okay? So I would try to teach you basically we'll start from the fact that even part of speech tagging might be helpful. What you could do, for example, are, let me just show you that and you can go home. Okay. There you have a pattern, cities such as Boston, Los Angeles, and Seattle. Now, if you did part of speech tagging on it, it gets you some sort of HTML structure, which is basically what we call English grammar. Okay, grammar is such an old term. HTML looks like more new, but part of speech tries to provide you the syntactic structure of the page, of the sentence. Now, I'm saying whenever I have a sentence like this, cities such as Boston, Los Angeles, Seattle, then these things are instances of this thing. So I can write a general extraction pattern saying whenever you see after part of speech tagging, see such as NP1, NP2, NP3, where NP1 is noun phrase 1, noun phrase 2, noun phrase 3, then you can go ahead and say the head of each of these noun phrases is an instance of C. Okay? Now, I skipped over the part of speech tagging. You know, if you take NLP course, you would know that lots and lots of techniques are there, augmented transition networks, etc., would do it for you. Okay? And now you're just, basically you got a DOM tree for English using this noun phrase, the part of speech structure of the page. And so now you can write a little bit of rules like this. Now, of course, most of these rules are unfortunately going to be bogus because they, for example, here, I listen to pretty much all music but prefer country such as Garth Brooks, which I think if you are a country music fan, you would realize that this guy is not a country. He's a person. Okay, but it does exactly satisfy that previous rule, country such as Garth Brooks. So how do you make sure that you won't suddenly make Garth Brooks a republic? Okay, basically that's where we do this hits-based analysis. And I'll send you that paper, read it, we'll talk about it. Okay.